Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this Quantum to Cosmos Festival presentation. My name is Michael Duchenne. I'm Chief Operating Officer at Perimeter Institute, and it's my great pleasure to welcome all of you in the Michael Lazaridis Theatre of Ideas at Perimeter in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and also a very warm welcome to all our viewers online from around the world. Just a couple of pieces of quick housekeeping before we begin. First of all, I'd like to ask everybody in the theater to turn off your Blackberries. Those of you at home, on the other hand, are welcome to keep them on and to share the news of this presentation with friends and colleagues and all the other presentations at the Quantum to Cosmos Festival. Email them the link, q2cfestival.com, and they can also follow us on Twitter as well. We're very, very pleased this afternoon to welcome a distinguished panel of quantum physicists, or quantum tamers, as we like to call them. I'm making reference to Perimeter Institute and Tidal Entertainment's award-winning documentary. We just had the Canadian premiere last night, wonderful documentary. It's showing throughout the festival in downtown Waterloo at the Princess Cinema, and it will also be shown on TVO next week, so I invite you to take in a screening. A number of our panelists are featured in that documentary. They do a wonderful job, so I encourage you to take an opportunity to see that. It's now my great pleasure to introduce the moderator of today's panel, Dr. Michele Mosca. Dr. Mosca is co-founder and deputy director of the Institute for Quantum Computing in Waterloo and also an associate faculty member here at Perimeter Institute. His research is in quantum algorithm design, and he's also known for his early work in nuclear magnetic resonance. Mike describes himself as a mathematician with a degree in computer science gained in a physics lab. So with his broad background, he's ideally suited to host today's distinguished panel on how to harness the power of quantum mechanics. Please welcome Dr. Michele Mosca.
Thanks very much, Michael, and well, thanks very much to you. We really appreciate the enthusiastic interest and support we get from the community. I'm going to quickly introduce our wonderful panel and then jump right into the theme of today's discussion. Our first panelist is Dorit Aharonov. Dr. Aharonov is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the Hebrew University in Israel. She did pioneering work in quantum computation, in particular with noisy quantum systems, and we'll hear more about that later, I'm sure. And she's also done groundbreaking work in quantum complexity and quantum algorithms, which deal with what is the power of a quantum computer? Her awards include the 2006 Kirill Prize. Our next panelist is Ignacio Sirac. Ignacio is the director of the theory division of the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics in Germany. He's well known for proposing one of the earliest and most successful approaches for the implementation of quantum computing, ion traps in particular, and he's also well known for his many other contributions to the theory of implementing quantum information processing, as well as his profound work on understanding the nature of quantum information. His numerous awards include the Prince of Asturias Award in 2006. The next panelist is Daniel Gottesman from the Perimeter Institute. Daniel's a leading expert on techniques for dealing with errors in quantum computing devices. He's also a leading figure in the application of quantum information for cryptographic purposes and other areas of quantum information as well. A few years ago, his awards include a few years ago being recognized as one of the top young innovators by the MIT Tech Review. Speaking of MIT, our next panelist is Peter Shor. He's a professor of applied mathematics at MIT. He transformed the field of quantum computing in 1994 when he discovered his now famous factoring algorithm, quantum factoring algorithm. And shortly after, he transformed the field again when he discovered how to correct quantum errors. And he continues working on various fundamental questions in theoretical aspects of quantum information. His numerous awards include the Nevelina Prize in 1998. This prize is awarded every 4 years for outstanding contributions in mathematical aspects of information sciences. And our last panelist is Avi Vigdorsson. Avi is a professor at the School of Mathematics at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. His research interests include randomness, the power of computers, cryptography, and also quantum computation and communication. He's a recipient of many awards. including the Nevin-Lena Prize that I just mentioned in 1994. So today we want to talk about harnessing quantum physics. And we're going to focus mostly on harnessing it for the purposes of information processing. So I think it would help if somebody, Dori, if you could tell us what quantum physics is.
Ooh, that's a very difficult question. So quantum physics is a theory that's been around for almost 100 years, and it's a very peculiar theory. It has this, for example, it has this very weird effect, theoretical possible effect, in which a cat can be both dead and alive. That's an experiment, just a thought experiment, was never actually conducted, suggested by Schrödinger, one of the founders of quantum mechanics, at 35, to demonstrate how peculiar the rules and laws of quantum mechanics can be. So obviously this is a very difficult thing to believe in, that a cat can be both dead and alive, and this was never actually observed. But for electrons and for small particles, this can actually happen and is being observed all the time, that these small particles can exhibit all their possible states at the same time. So for example, an electron can be both here and there at the same time, simultaneously. And in some sense, it's like it's being a little bit here and a little bit there, and it's not deciding where it is. It's in both places at the same time. And this principle is called the superposition principle. Now, there's another very important principle in quantum mechanics, which is called the measurement principle, which is, suppose a physicist or anybody wants to ask a system, like an electron, a physical system, where are you, actually? You want to measure it. Well, then, once a physical system is being asked something like this, it has to answer, even though it does not know where it is. So the measurement process, the measurement principle, according to quantum mechanics, says that the answer is probabilistic, meaning that the system, in some random way, decides whether it's here or there. And this is a very peculiar phenomenon. That's one of the most counterintuitive parts of quantum mechanics. So these two principles will play an important role in the future and in the next hour.
Well, thanks. Does anyone else want to add to that? I thought that was very good.
There's another important part of quantum mechanics. In classical information processing, the unit, fundamental unit, is a bit, which is something that can either be zero or one, or something that can be in two possible states. If you have a quantum information processing, you deal with qubits, which is a state of a quantum system. Now, in classical information, if you have n quantum bits, they can be in 2 to the n, or exponentially many different states. In quantum information processing, if you look at a system of n quantum bits, there are doubly exponential states that they can possibly be in. So really, there's a lot more room in quantum state space than in classical state space. And this is something that's very important in quantum information processing as well.
Thanks. That's a really nice example of how quantum mechanics changes the rules of the game for something very simple, a string of bits. If perchance you didn't entirely understand what quantum information is, or quantum physics is, after these great explanations, you're in good company, and you might want to watch Quantum Tamers, or there's other material available. But I'd like to move on and really just start to understand the consequences of quantum physics. So Peter already touched upon it a bit for information processing. But Dori, do you maybe want to elaborate a bit about? So there's quantum physics, and so what does that? How does that affect computation and information processing in general?
Peter mentioned this fact that. So actually, let's go backwards. So we have this superposition principle in which a quantum system can be in all its possible situations, which is a very difficult thing to understand, but let's assume it. Let's take it as an assumption. So then, if you have one particle, which can be in its two possible states simultaneously, you add to it another particle, it can be in its two possible states simultaneously. And if you look at the system of many particles, actually just 100, which is a very small physical system, it can be in 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 100 times. And this is a huge space. So the state of the quantum system is described in this exponentially large space, vector space. And the computational properties of quantum mechanics is basically the ability to manipulate this the state of the system in this huge, amazingly large space. And we just, what we are trying to do with quantum computers is take advantage of this amazingly huge space describing the state of a very small physical system.
So there seems to be this huge potential, this much more rich reality that we didn't know about 100 years ago. This potential to exploit it. And I guess the field really exploded in 1994 when Peter came up with this famous factoring paper. Do you want to maybe describe what the problem is and why people cared so much about it?
Okay, so factoring, well, first, if you have two numbers, say 7 and 13, it's fairly easy to multiply them together and get 91. And if you did this with 500-digit numbers, you know, you could sit down and it would take a little while, but you could do it, and computers can do it really, really quickly. But suppose you look at the reverse process. You're given 91, and you want to get 7 times 13 equals 91. This is the factoring problem. And, you know, with 91, I think any of you could sit down and figure out that 91 was 7 times 13. But suppose I give you a 1,000-digit number, which is the product of two 500-digit numbers. I mean, well, multiplying 500-digit numbers, I'm sure you could do it if you just took, you know, a quarter of an hour or something. But if you took a 1,000-digit number, I want to break it down into two 500-digit numbers, nobody knows how to do this, not even with the fastest computers in the world. Theoretically, you can write programs that do this, but they'll take longer than the age of the universe to finish. And so this is, you know, this might seem an abstruse mathematical question. And it's that, I mean, it's an important mathematical question, but it's also very important for cryptography. Because if you, say, want to buy something over Amazon, what they do is they encode your credit card number before they send it, and Amazon, you know, gets your credit card number and decodes it. And they want to do this so that nobody who is listening in on this conversation by one of the computers that this message goes through can get your credit card number. And they do this by encoding it using something called the RSA crypto system, which is based on, well, RSA stands for its founders, Rivest, Shamir, and Edelman. And it's based on the difficulty of factoring large numbers. So if you had an algorithm, a computer program, that was able to factor 500-digit numbers, then you could break this code and find all the credit card numbers and actually much more important information that's sent over the internet. So factoring became a very important practical problem because of this crypto system.
So people started to panic because all the main codes being used, or most of them were compromised. Could a quantum computer break all codes?
Well, so if you look at the history of coding theory, or the history of secret codes, for nearly an entire history of the secret codes, two people shared a secret and used this to encode and decode information. And if you look at the codes that depend on secret keys, quantum computers cannot break most of those. But if you look, you know, I mean, if you buy something from Amazon, you haven't gotten together with Amazon ahead of time and agreed on a secret key. And in fact, it would be utterly impractical to do so with today's internet. So what you have to do is use a public key crypto system where you derive the key by exchanging messages to each other. And that uses the fact that, you know, you can take two, or your computer actually takes two long numbers, multiplies them together, and that gives you the key. And then Amazon can send you messages that only you can read because you know these two numbers that multiply together to get this large number, but you sent this large number to Amazon, and they use this large number to encode the message, and you use the fact that you know the two numbers that went into making it to decode. So this is a public key crypto system. And many of the public key crypto systems, all the ones that were in use in practice, are broken by a quantum computer. There are some public key crypto systems that have been proposed that have not yet been broken by a quantum computer, and nobody knows whether it's possible for them to be broken by a quantum computer or not. But if anyone developed quantum computers, we'd have to switch over to these other public key crypto systems, which are actually a lot less efficient, and it would be a big change.
And maybe someday those would be broken too, so.
Right.
On the other hand, it's possible that if you have quantum computers, you can construct other public key systems with them that cannot be broken by quantum computers.
So it gets really confusing. So which problems can be solved by a quantum computer, which ones can't? It'd just be nice to know in advance. And I guess this is one of your areas of expertise, Avi, like understanding the complexity of problems and so on. So can you shed a little light on computational complexity, how quantum information fits in, maybe a bit of this P versus NP problem? Can quantum computers solve all of NP and so on?
Sure, in only 2 minutes.
Yep.
So I'll try. So my research area is computational complexity theory, which deals with basically which problems are hard to solve and which problems are easy to solve. And easy and hard are quantified mathematically, but we don't need to get into this. It's sufficient to say that all the things that you see implemented on computers or on systems that you use are problems that were algorithmically solved efficiently. So if some geometric problems were solved, and some of them were, some natural ones, this enables all your computer games. And some, computational, just arithmetic things are those that do your, text returns. And problems on sequences that were solved algorithmically are the ones that do your text processing, but are also the ones that do genomics. So there's a bunch of natural questions, computational questions, for which we found efficient algorithms, and those enable all the wonderful things that you see implemented. The class of things that we can solve efficiently is called P, for polynomial time, for those who are interested where this P is coming from. There are lots more natural questions that we would like to solve, that everybody would like to solve. There's a bunch of optimization problems that, natural optimal resource allocations in whatever you have, in schedules, in energy, et cetera, et cetera. There are problems like, in number theory, in mathematics in general, like the factoring problem. There are problems of entertainment, maybe solving a crossword puzzle or Sudoku puzzles and so on. And lots of problems for which we would like to have efficient algorithms, but the best ones we have right now are more or less brute force. So Peter described the factoring problem. Suddenly we can solve it. We can just try all possible, if I give you a 1,000 digit number, you can try all possible partitions into 500 digit numbers, try to multiply them and see whether you get what you wanted. But that's the number of possibilities is exponential. And so this algorithm is practically useless. And it's the same with lots of other problems that we would like to solve. The best algorithm we have is this exponential time brute force algorithm. There's a particular class of problems that we would, we all would die to solve, and would actually really encompass almost everything we want to efficiently solve. That class is called NP. That's a class of problems for which, if we see a solution, we recognize it's a good one. So if I gave you the factors of this 1,000 digit number, doesn't matter how I got it, doesn't matter if I used, a billion years to solve it, once I give it to you, it's the right solution because you can multiply and check. So almost all things we are looking for, everybody, scientists, mathematicians, the industry, are problems of this type. Once you have a good allocation of resources, you know, which cost you that much, then you know that it costs you that much. Maybe it was hard to solve. Once I told you how to pack your, you know, your 17 suitcases as you go on a camping trip into your the back of your car, you'd recognize that you can close the trunk, but maybe if I just let you try, you'd never figure out. So the class of problems of this nature for which verification is easy is called NP. And I won't tell you why the acronym is there, but anyway, so the question of whether P equals NP, a great scientific question of the day, one of the most important questions in science and mathematics, is whether these two classes are equal. And one good way to remember it is the following. Do all the problems that we want to solve efficiently, we can. Okay, so P is the things we can solve efficiently. NP are the things we'd like to solve efficiently. So one more point about this question. As I told you, the factoring problem is in NP. You can verify good factors if you see them. We think it's a difficult problem. In fact, the world is basing its, if all of you shop on Amazon or on the internet in general, you are gambling on the fact that this problem is hard. We don't really know that it's hard. We don't really know. We already know that it's solvable on quantum computer, but we don't have the quantum computer. So a point that I want to make is that hard problems, if it's really hard, can be useful. So not only easy problems are useful, hard problems can be useful, and hard problems are driving cryptography and electronic commerce. We would like to prove it's hard. We don't have the tools for this yet.
Maybe I'd like to add one comment to that. So. Quantum computers are basically a revolution. The revolution was launched into the air by Shor's algorithm of factoring. But the reason for the revolution, other than for the amazing practical implications, is exactly that they redefine what is an easy and what is a hard problem. So until quantum computers, easy problems was one class, and hard problems like NP problems with another class. And basically, all computers had essentially the same abilities. So for all computers, easy problems are easy and hard problems are hard. And with the invention of quantum computers, suddenly this class of easy, possibly easy problems that can, in principle, be solved efficiently is changing. And factoring, if we have a quantum computer, will become an easy problem.
Well, let me just even elaborate. We can talk between us.
Yeah.
So that's. I just want to clarify the point that Dorit made. When I said easy or efficiently solvable, it always meant, also before the age of computers, it meant what we could do efficiently with our means. It may have been the abacus in ancient times. And if quantum computers become available, those will be algorithms that are efficient on quantum computers. It's possible, and we don't know that. It's quite possible, although I don't think many believe it, that quantum computers could be simulated efficiently on classical computers. That's a possibility. This possibility would mean that we don't need to bother building them. Of course, it's only a possibility, and we don't know that. It's another possibility that tomorrow somebody would find a classical efficient algorithm for factoring integers. So we have this efficient algorithm on a hypothetical quantum computer, maybe there is just a classical algorithm that works as well. It's a possibility.
So they can factor large numbers, which is good for breaking cryptography we use today. We don't think they can solve NP hard problems, but we don't really know. Most of the people in the audience, they're good people. They don't want to break codes. So people have said, you know, why are we spending this big effort trying to build a code-breaking machine, a factoring machine? Is there any reason to build a quantum computer other than to solve these mathematical problems? Yeah.
Well, so another thing that quantum computers are very good at is simulating quantum systems. So, you know, a molecule is made up of atoms. The atoms behave quantum mechanically. And if you want to know how they behave, well, you could simulate that on a regular classical computer. But to do that, you need a really big classical computer and a really small molecule. But a quantum computer could do it, because quantum computers naturally behave quantum mechanically. And admittedly, most of you are probably not going to want to do this at home. But a lot of physicists and chemists and so on would really like to know how molecules behave. Or you can put the atoms together into a solid, and maybe that solid forms a new superconductor or some other material with interesting properties. And the quantum properties of the atoms making it up will be very important in that behavior. And a quantum computer could help us simulate and understand how it will behave and tell us how it will behave before we actually build these things.
Let me add that pharmaceutical companies right now spend millions of dollars simulating the quantum mechanics of, well, drug molecules, molecules that make up drugs. And if you built quantum computers, they're very likely to be able to speed this up and reduce the cost of simulating molecules. And the pharmaceutical companies would certainly love to be able to do this much more efficiently.
Let me add just one more example, and this would add also to the collection of quantum algorithms you know. So you heard about Peter's factoring algorithm. At about the same time, Love Grover invented an algorithm that's called the database search algorithm, which is basically how to search in an exponential space using a quantum computer. Now, this algorithm is not like Peter's algorithm that seems to exhibit an exponential gap on the power of classical. It just saves a quadratic factor in the time. But a quadratic factor can be huge. So if you use a million steps, it will go down to a thousand steps. And, well, you can extrapolate. I can give other numbers, but you can get, you save a square root of the number. Now, for those problems I mentioned before, this NP hard problems, those problems that we would all like to solve and for which the best algorithms run in exponential time, you sometimes have practical problems with a thousand, I don't know, digits or a map with a thousand nodes, etc. And exponential in that number is too huge, but maybe the square root of this exponential is something that you can approach. At least for some practical problems, it would be an amazing improvement to run at the square root of the time. And this algorithm, Grover's algorithm, is applicable essentially to any such problem.
So let me just add on that, so over the past 10 years, there has been a few more algorithms in various areas related mainly to problems that interest mathematicians. But the main point, I think, is that we still don't have a quantum computer, and as long as we don't have a quantum computer, we are really very far from understanding its capabilities. So I think we are just at the tip of the iceberg of understanding which algorithms, we just cannot imagine what we'll be able to do once we have a quantum computer. Just as before classical computers were realized, we didn't know what we would use them for.
So a lot of these examples were things that were discovered in the 90s. Have we been stuck for 10, 15 years? Has anything truly interesting happened in terms of applications of quantum computers since we entered the field? Anybody want to?
Well, just last year there was a recent algorithm for solving linear equations using a quantum computer. So linear equations basically, these are large systems of linear equations. A linear equation, basically, you know, if you do something, then there's a reaction that's proportional to what you do. So if you push harder, you know, twice as hard, then the result is going to be twice as big, that sort of thing. And linear equations show up all over the place, in economics, in engineering, all over the place. And people like to solve them, of course, and find out what the solutions are that give you some particular configuration. And there's limits to quantum computers. You can't get exactly the answer that you want, but you can somehow approximate it and get some information about the answer. And so there's some situations in which this quantum algorithm might be really very, very useful. That was just last year, as I said.
So Ignacio, you were?
Similar.
Oh, OK. And Peter?
Yeah, so linear equations as a system, as an example of problems which are generally thought to be solvable efficiently on a classical computer. But what this result shows is there are some situations where, even though there's generally thought to be solvable efficiently on a classical computer, a quantum computer can solve them much more efficiently than a classical computer. So we don't have to limit our uses of quantum computers to problems which are hard for classical computers. There are many problems which are considered efficient on a classical computer, but which are still, you know, reaching the boundaries of our computation because they're efficient, but they're not that efficient. And if quantum computers could speed up these problems, it would be very useful as well.
I want to add that so the study of quantum algorithms is theoretical right now because we don't have the machines to run them on. But this quantum algorithmic theory is developing and is parallel, the development is parallel the classical complexity theory development. And in it, there are lots of other notions of computing besides standard algorithms. And one important variant is proofs. So proofs are studied in standard computational theory, and in it proof is the type I mentioned before. I could convince you that two numbers are the factors of another bigger number. So one could study quantum proofs and quantum in algorithms for doing quantum proofs for one powerful entity to convince another that something, some mathematical fact is correct. There have been enormous progress in the recent years, and in fact, we know today, due to a result just from a few months ago, to characterize exactly the power of quantum proofs in terms of classical complexity. It turns out that what quantum proofs can do is exactly what can be classically computed with small memory, with efficient size memory, without blowing up the memory unit.
Well, in my opinion, one of the most interesting developments over the past few years in quantum information science is actually a bridge that was recreated between physics and computer science. So quantum computing is a bridge like that, but over the past few years, there's a new bridge that's called quantum Hamiltonian complexity, which Ignacio is one of the world experts on that. And it basically gives a handle on physical system, a way to study physical systems from a computational point of view, and gives a completely new point on and way to address questions that physicists have been interested in over the years. So maybe...
this was a big surprise, I think, for both communities, computer science and physicists, the fact that they have anything to do with each other. Well, we knew it in the field of quantum computing, and it was in that case that physics can somehow help in computer science by building some device, and then computer scientists will tell us how to use it. And it's a little bit the other way around. So we have many devices in physics, many systems, but we don't understand how they work. Especially you have, Daniel has mentioned before, that if you have certain materials and you cool down to very low temperature, then start behaving in a very strange way. So these quantum mechanical properties that Dorit was mentioning, that electrons can be in two places at the same time, start manifesting themselves at very low temperatures, and then there is no way that we can understand or that we can describe them with the systems that we have. Of course, if we would have a quantum computer, on the one hand, this could help us to understand these systems, and this was mentioned before. This is what we call quantum simulations, and maybe one of the most important applications of quantum computer. But on the other hand, people coming from computer science are teaching us ways of solving these problems, and also that some problems we will never be able to solve. So we will not be able to describe completely with the methods that we can ever create, basically, some of the systems that we have at hand. And this gives us a very, very nice bridge between two completely different fields of science, namely computer science and physics.
Okay, so that's reassuring, and it's good. So a lot of the ideas from quantum information are affecting and helping other fields, and I believe there's other examples in classical complexity theory where quantum ideas have helped understand just purely classical systems better. I want to switch gears now, because we've talked a lot about what quantum mechanics is, what quantum information is, what would be the consequences of harnessing it. If there's time, I'll come back later to that question. But when we switched into the, we started working in this field in the mid-90s, a lot of people told us we were crazy because it'll never work. You know, that people are trying to build these things, they're failing miserably, they'll never be able to build one, it's just too hard. Daniel, do you want to maybe elaborate a bit on this whole issue of will we ever build one? Why haven't we built one yet?
Right. Well, so there's a lot of reason to believe that errors are going to be a very big problem for a quantum computer. So, of course, it's natural that, you know, if you first try to build something, then all the pieces are not going to work right. But really, today, we have very elaborate classical computers, you know, with millions, billions of bits, and they almost never make mistakes. I mean, obviously, if somebody programs them wrong, they make a mistake. But the hardware is very, very reliable. For a quantum computer, that probably won't be the case. And there's a number of reasons for that. One of them is simply, in order to get this quantum mechanical behavior we need for a quantum computer to work, you have to go to very, very, very small objects, like single atoms. And of course, a small object is going to be more susceptible to getting knocked around than a bigger object. And so there's more likely that something will hit it and knock it out of the correct state. So a zero could become a one. But more than that, quantum states, which you need to have a quantum computer, are very, very delicate just inherently. And the reason for this is gets back to this measurement principle that Dorit mentioned, which is that if you look at a quantum state to try to figure out, say, whether it's a zero or a one, you'll collapse it. You'll change the state. And it doesn't have to be a person that's looking at it. It could be a machine, or it could even just be another atom that's nearby, this first atom that you care about. And it's very, very hard to take even a single atom and isolate it completely from everything around it so that nothing learns any information about what state it's in. And so if you've isolated as well as you can, but it's not perfect, then a little bit of information will leak out, and the state will eventually collapse. And then it'll be like a classical bit, which is still worth something, but it's not as good as a quantum bit, right? That's what we've been talking about so far. So in order to make quantum computers work, we're going to need some way to correct these errors. And Peter Shor and Andy Steen discovered in the mid-90s, perhaps shortly after these skeptical comments were made to Mike, that actually there is a way to correct errors on a quantum computer using something called the quantum error correcting code. Now, I said regular classical computers don't have to worry very much about errors, but actually communications lines, like telephone lines or wireless communication, depend very much on our ability to correct errors. And so there are classical error correcting codes that deal with that. So we now know ways to make quantum error correcting codes. It's more challenging than with classical error correcting codes. But more than that, we can find fault-tolerant quantum computations so that even if there's an error during the computation, it doesn't spread and destroy the whole computation. We can contain it and kind of erase it. And meanwhile, we have a computation that's going on in these encoded states that's going to eventually tell us the right answer. And so if we've proven what's called the threshold theorem, which says that if the error rate in each little gate that we do in the quantum computer, each operation, is below some constant value, say one error per 10,000 steps, then we can do arbitrarily long quantum computations and still get the right answer.
So we learned that if we could ever harness quantum systems, we could do these really useful things. And then, of course, at the time, people said, you'll never build them. Quantum errors will kill you. And then, I think Peter and Daniel and Dorit also made fundamental contributions to this threshold theorem. Said, you don't need perfect control. You just need, good control. Where good was one error in 10,000 or something, to which I think back then experimentalists laughed extensively because they didn't think they could ever reach those thresholds. Have the demands changed since 96 or so? Like, are we still demanding that much from the experimentalists? Are we saying, you don't even need to do that well?
Well, actually,
how far down does it go?
Actually, the original estimates were that you needed one error per million gates. And so we've improved it. It seems like one error per 1,000 gates should be enough, but in that case, you need lots and lots and lots of extra qubits, and you have to do lots and lots of extra work. So one error per 10,000 gates is probably about right. That's pretty hard, but it's at least possible in principle with a lot of the systems people are considering.
So how ridiculous is that, this one in 1,000, or maybe someday we'll get even slightly lower, but like, have we made serious progress since 95 or so when people really started trying? To almost 15 years later, Ignacio, I guess you're the expert on this. If you want to let us know, if we, have we been banging our heads against the wall for 15 years, and we're, or have, do we have something to show for?
Okay, so we've been talking so far about a quantum computer is something that does not exist because we don't have a quantum computer. We don't have a system with which we can build a full functioning quantum computer. However, we know that there are systems that in which in principle we could build a quantum computer, and since 1995 and so, people have been working experiments trying to tame those small systems, and there have been enormous progress since they started. So we can say that today we can build small prototypes of quantum computers which have something like 8 atoms or 10 atoms. And with these atoms, people are able to create these superpositions, so to make them behave in many different ways at the same time, and to check all the laws of quantum mechanics, so to make sure that we are right, that we are not just using a theory that is wrong, that we are right. And at the same time, they have been showing that how big are the errors. And in the experiments that we have so far, so there are several kinds of errors. Some of them have been pushed all the way to the end of this 1 over 10,000, so they're okay. So in principle, with that, we could build a quantum computer, but some of the errors are at the level still of 1 every 100 operations, so we still have to push them a little bit further. And on top of that, with these experimental systems that people are using in the labs, there is another problem, is that they have been shown that these errors are very small if you have 2 or 3 atoms, or 4 atoms. And when you put another one, when you add another qubit to your system, then for all the theories of error correction, then the error shouldn't increase, shouldn't be not more difficult to make the same operation if you have 5 or 10 or 20 atoms. And that's, at the moment, a challenge that people are trying to set up. So there are already experiments that have shown that when you increase by an atom or 2 atoms, then the errors stay the same. That's a good indication. But still, we are very far from having a full quantum computer. So just to give you an order of magnitude, you would like to build a quantum computer that would factorize numbers better than any classical computer. We should have of the order of 10,000 of these atoms if there would be no error. But if there are errors, because of these error corrections require some overhead, then we would need many more atoms of the order of 100,000, millions, or something like that. So at the moment, we have 8 to 10. And this is progressing every year, but we're still very far away from having a quantum computer. So in principle, it's possible. In practice, people are trying and improving. But what is clear is that it will take a long time to get there.
So let me add a comment just to show how long we've gone. In 1994, when I came up with a factoring algorithm, some people told me that if you looked at all the experiments done in physics so far, you could say that some of them have done something like 1/2 of an operation on 2 quantum bits. Now we have, maybe 100 operations on 4 or 5 or 6 quantum bits. And to actually do important work on quantum computers, we probably need millions or billions of operations on thousands of quantum bits. So we have a long way to go before we get to real quantum computation, but we've come an enormous way in the last 15 years. And part of this is due to clever theorists like Ignacio who came up with really inventive ways of building quantum computers, and part of it is the experimentalists have made enormous progress.
So maybe let me add. So maybe I look very, very pessimistic, I mean, saying that we have 8 and happen in 10 years, and so we still have to go up to millions. But of course, we have gone from 0, basically, from 0 to 8. And so going from 0 to 8 is very, it's very hard, and it was very hard, but it managed.
It's a factor of infinity.
It's a factor of infinity, yes. Yes, well, I remember that when we were talking about quantum computers in 95, some people were saying, completely impossible that you have even a quantum computer with, let's say, 5 qubits in 10 years. So people saw this as impossible from the experimental point of view. We are there, but we still have a very long way to go.
So at this ion trap proposal that you pioneered went from 0 to 8. And is that what a quantum computer is? Are we're going to trap ions, or is the field all invested in this, or is there 2 proposals? Is the number of proposals growing or shrinking? Or if you can give us a sense of the breadth of sort of the attack on harnessing quantum physics.
So at the moment we know several systems in which in principle one could build a quantum computer. There are systems based on atoms, in which each atom would be one of these quantum bits, one of these qubits. There are systems formed of electrons in what is called quantum dots, so in some material, they're able to trap electrons, and these electrons act as qubits. There are superconducting devices in which a qubit is formed by a current, and if the current is going one way, it's like zero, and the other way is one. We have atoms within molecules in NMR quantum computation, so we have a series of systems in which we know that in principle it would be possible to create a quantum, to build a quantum computer, and with which people have done experiments and have shown that anyone can do it with one qubit, two qubits, three qubits, and still, I mean, we have not reached this one million. So I would say that there are many systems at the moment that people are investigating, but what is clear is that, I mean, whenever we build a quantum computer, and it's something that I'm sure that will happen, I don't know when, but it will happen, it will probably have absolutely nothing to do with the systems that we have now at hand. And we have seen this in science, in many cases, in the case of classical computers, or the computers that people imagined 50 years ago have absolutely nothing to do with our laptops or desktops. We were thinking that it would be a big building and full of machines and levers and so on, and this has nothing to do. So we expect that, or we hope that there will be several technological revolutions that will allow us to speed the process of building a quantum computer, but it's impossible to predict what are the revolutions that will happen until we reach that.
So, like in the mid-90s, these superconducting qubits, for example, they weren't even in our imagination. And then 5 or so years later, they were sort of doing one qubit, and now they're kind of doing two, and the ions went from 0 to 8. And so, I mean, is this the right measure, the number of qubits we've harnessed? Is the field really going to go from 8 to 16 linearly? But so is it,
well, the hope is that we can build scalable systems. So I told you before that the problem that we have right now is that people are able to do things with 5, 6, 8 qubits very well, or reasonably well, but whenever they try to put 12, then they are not able to do the same even with the 8 qubits that they had before. So it's a problem of scaling. And there are ways around that. There are ways of separating your qubits in such a way when you do computation with some of the qubits, you don't affect the rest, and then you move them around. Or with these superconducting devices, in which, in principle, you could scale up the system. So the hope is that at some point, we will be able to show that one can scale these systems, and then it will be simpler to go up. But this has not been shown so far.
Maybe I'll take your role and ask Ignacio a question. So just to point out that there is another possibility for the quantum computer project besides just failure. This scalability, of course, there's success, which will be maybe the best of all worlds, and there's maybe just stupid failure because technology is not, you know, we can't harness it well enough. But there's another possibility, which I think some people take seriously, and that's my question, is that quantum mechanics, the theory itself, doesn't scale. So what it tells us about the behavior of small systems like 10 atoms or 20 atoms just doesn't apply when it comes to 1,000 or 1,000,000. You just have to revise the theory when you deal with large quantum systems that you are supposed to behave perfectly in superposition, but maybe they don't because there's a law of nature we didn't discover yet. So there's one potential of this quantum computing project is that we'll discover a new physical theory. What I would like to ask is what's the feeling among the physicists about this possibility?
Well, personally, I would be more excited if there is a new theory that it overcomes quantum mechanics. But even if it's like that, it's very likely that a quantum computer still exists, so that this theory would be compatible with the fact that one can build a quantum computer. But anyways, it's like every time in physics that we are trying to cross a border, a frontier. So there is some region that we have not explored before, and now we're exploring. So we are building these superpositions, which are bigger and bigger and bigger, and we don't know what will come. So maybe there are surprises, and I'm sure that there will be surprises. And maybe one of these surprises is that there is another theory, which, of course, if it's different than quantum mechanics, we may have some other applications which can be even better than the ones that we had before.
So maybe this was not mentioned during this panel. But, you know, we're talking about applications of and realization of these quantum computers, which is very, very far away. But there is another application of quantum information processing, which is quantum cryptography. So quantum information processing seems to ruin classical cryptography. So what it does is it also offers its own cryptography, which is quantum cryptography, which is actually something practical. So in order to do quantum cryptography, one actually needs to send photons in the air, and this is technology that exists already today.
So that's very interesting. So as we're moving along from 0 to 1 to 8, you know, quantum bits, so along the way, there's stuff we can do with 1-bit and 2-bit, and I know there's other examples, which I guess we won't have time to get into. So as we go along, there's all sorts of applications, some of which we anticipated, some of which we didn't, and I guess the hope is someday it works well enough we can just integrate it into a big computer. And there's, you know, probably some applications where 100 bits is enough, but others will need millions, and that will take, you know, a few more years, maybe the second or third generation. So we're either going to take off, or hopefully, if we fail, we'll discover something fundamental about our universe, which for many people would be even more exciting. But it might not kill quantum computers. It might give us a stronger computer or just a different looking computer. And of course, I guess the bad thing would be if we just fail and give up because we get too upset.
Funding will stop.
Yeah, well, that's one reason I guess it could stop. Tragically, where we're close to a breakthrough. Of course, you never know when the breakthrough is going to happen. So that's a very helpful painting, a snapshot of the field, I guess. That's been very helpful. To wrap things up, I guess I'd like to, on a personal note, ask you each, maybe starting with Peter, before your 1994 paper, there was just a very small group of people looking at quantum computing, and to first order, nobody cared about what they were doing. So what motivated you to look at it and to stay in the field? Because you were doing other interesting stuff at the time.
Well, so I guess I first heard about quantum computing from a talk by Umesh Vazirani, who had, you know, this idea about quantum, you know, he'd heard about quantum computers. So let's go back a little bit. Quantum computers were started by David Deutsch, who everyone thought was at least a little bit crackpot, and he published a paper that's, you know, laid out the basic ideas of what is a quantum computer, and then he and Richard Joza found a problem, which was a very contrived problem, which a quantum computer could do a little bit better than a classical computer, and Umesh Vazirani, who was a computer scientist, saw this, and he started working out the basic theory of quantum computing. And I heard this talk by Umesh Vazirani when I was at Bell Labs, and I'd taken a lot of physics as an undergrad, which you might think is completely useless for someone who's working in algorithms in regular computing. But anyway, I got interested in it and started thinking about what quantum computers could do. And then I saw a paper by Dan Simon, who came up with another contrived problem for which quantum computers could do exponentially better than classical computers. And I looked at Dan Simon's paper, and I realized that this was based on periodicity. So periodicity is, you know, a periodic sequence goes 1, 3, 5, 7, 1, 3, 5, 7, 1, 3, 5, 7, it repeats itself. And I knew that factoring could be solved by periodicity. The problem is that you have, you know, to solve factoring by periodicity, you need to find the period of an exponentially long, a sequence with an exponentially long period. But it happens that the exponential size state space in quantum computers can handle this. So after thinking about this for, you know, several months, I was able to come up with a factoring algorithm. And then the field just took off.
And you couldn't. You wanted to stay in it, I guess, which was definitely good for the field.
Yeah. Well, there was still lots of stuff to do in this field. Yeah. And it's really fun working in a field right at the beginning of the field because there's lots of things to do, lots of interesting open questions which nobody's answered. They're easier to answer than working in fields where everybody has already answered all the easy questions. So I stayed in the field because it was fun and it, you know, And I was getting lots of results.
I like how you painted the progression from just this crazy idea to people solving contrived problems to study the power of this framework, to then a breakthrough on a practical problem, and so on. Ignacio, you were a quickly rising star in quantum optics, in a very exciting time for the field, doing wonderful things there. So what motivated you to jump into this strange new field, talking to these computer scientists that you probably couldn't understand at the time?
Well, I was working at that time with Peter Zoller, and so we were looking at how to control and tame atomic systems, so how to be able to isolate one atom from the rest of the atoms of the universe, or two atoms, or three atoms. And we didn't know anything about quantum computation at that time. It was 1994, 1993. And then Arthur Eckert gave a talk, a well-known scientist in the field, gave a talk in a conference where we were there, and he was talking about the quantum computers, and so what beautiful would be if we could build a quantum computer, but nobody knows how to build a quantum computer. So for us, it was very natural to take the system we were working with and to see how you can build a quantum computer with that. And since then on, we have been continuing working on that system and trying to see how we can build maybe bigger and bigger computers, and this drag us into the field of quantum information.
Yeah, dragged in, yeah. Daniel, when you joined the field, you were a student. You didn't have the luxury of being established and so on. What was a bit crazy, according to some people, for you to
Well, maybe. To so in 1994, I was a graduate student at Caltech. And I was working on black hole evaporation, actually, another thing that fits in well at Perimeter, but not so well on this panel. But I didn't really feel like I was making any progress on that. I didn't think I could solve it. Solve the questions I wanted to answer. So my advisor, John Preskill, said, well, here's something interesting, and gave me a paper describing Shor's algorithm, which had just been discovered. And, well, here I am now.
Okay. So you were kind of pushed into the field. And then, and Dori, same question for you.
So for me, it was pure luck. I was looking for something to do research about that would catch my passion. And I was actually thinking about brain research and consciousness and stuff like that. And then I knocked on my future advisor. I didn't know it would be my advisor, Michael Benor, one of my advisors. Avi's also my advisor. And I knocked on Michael Benor's door. And when I entered, he said, well, okay, consciousness is very, very interesting, but let me tell you something really interesting that's been going on. And he told me about quantum computing. It was for me a very fascinating place, because it was a combination of math and physics. It gave basically the ability to ask philosophical and very conceptual questions using mathematical and physical tools. And for me, this combination was very, very interesting.
Okay, so dragged, pushed, and just randomly stumbled into the field. And Avi, do you wish you had jumped into the field back in the 90s?
Before Peter discovered the algorithm, which I think is shared by lots of people, this wish, this desire. No, I'm very happy doing what I'm doing with classical computational complexity. The main problem I wish I knew how to solve, and I invite all you, especially those who are students here, to try help us, is to really be able to prove that some computational problems are difficult, that they cannot be solved efficiently by either classical computers or quantum computers. That's the kind of grand challenge of the field. That's a P different than NP conjecture. But I want to point out to some connection that came on the collaboration between computer scientists going to physics and physicists going to computer science, and this collaboration going on and being extremely exciting. It's not surprising at all, and this is happening between computer scientists and computational theorists with lots of other scientists or other sciences. Happens with other branches of physics, like statistical physics, in understanding just matter. It happens with biologists in understanding bioinformatics. It happens with neuroscientists in understanding the brain. And I can give you, 10 or 20 other examples. And the reason that it's natural and it's happening and it's growing all the time is that nature is full of algorithms. You know, everything computes. The brain computes, the cell computes, the DNA computes, atoms compute, the stars compute, and therefore the language of computing, the language of algorithms, is essential for understanding these natural phenomena, for understanding nature. And so there are lots of collaborations that have started in the last, you know, maybe decade, 15 years, and the wealth of understanding on both sides, both the wealth of new algorithmic questions asked by these sciences to computer scientists, the you know, the kind of algorithms. You probably know about the importance of algorithms for the genome project. I mean, it was basically algorithms for sequencing that shortened the life of this project probably by 10 years. So this collaboration is natural and will just, you know, just grow.
Thanks very much for that. Let's start. If people have questions, I think it's time to take some questions from the audience. If you could just come up on this side of the hall. While people start approaching the microphone, let's thank our panel for this wonderful discussion. Yes, please.
I have two questions. First is sort of a clarification. Could you describe a quantum computer almost like, or the way it would solve a factoring problem, almost like the multiple states being like different shapes, and the solution being, let's say, a cube, and so the quantum computer being able to be in a number of different states, and then once it finds the two states that just fit together to form that cube, it knows it's found its solution.
So the way I can think of I think of the quantum computer as solving the factoring problem is a classical computer, you think of it just doing one path. Now, quantum mechanics has the property that things can be in many states at once, and so a quantum computer basically searches lots and lots of different paths. And to get the answer, I mean, some of these paths lead to the right answer, and some of these paths lead to the wrong answer, what you have to do is use the principle of quantum interference. And you make all the paths that lead to the right answer interfere constructively, so the probability is greatly multiplied that they get the right answer, and all the paths that lead to the wrong answer interfere destructively, so the probability goes down to almost zero. And the hard part of designing quantum computer algorithms is arranging this interference between all the paths that produce the right answer to be make the probability of the right answer be increased and the probability of the wrong answer be decreased.
And second question I had was, how is quantum computers theoretically going to affect things like chaos theory and maybe like weather prediction and other applications such as that?
Do you want to take that, Daniel?
Okay. Well, so right now we don't know of a good quantum algorithm that would really help, I think, for any of those problems. The Grover search algorithm that Avi mentioned could help basically any problem where you have to try out lots of possibilities. The Grover's algorithm can reduce the number of possibilities you have to try. But one of the main problems in understanding chaotic systems and in predicting their behavior is that you have to know exactly what the state is at the very beginning. And then if you try to evolve it forward in time, but you have slightly the wrong initial state, it'll very quickly change. So for instance, weather, predicting a couple of days ahead of time, we can do that. But as you get further and further, you know, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, even very small differences in the temperature or the wind or whatever can totally change the weather 4 weeks from now. So quantum computers probably won't be able to help with that problem.
Thanks very much.
Hi, I'm a student at the University of Waterloo, and I'd like to thank you, first of all, for talking here today. My question has to do with the theme of the talk, which is harnessing quantum physics. And I want to play on another facet of your work. And the question is, how is the progress of this technology monitored within the international community? Who will ensure its use will not be malicious? The example being warfare driven by such technology. You've already mentioned corrupt cryptography. I like that example a lot. Thank you for bringing it up. Being experts in your field, I wanted to ask, what are some of the possible negative social implications of your research, and where does the responsibility lie in the future?
So that's a very big question. Do you want to
I could try to answer. I'm very much bothered by this question. I think the responsibility is on society as a whole. I mean, I think the more powerful we become, the more we can do both good and bad. And how we use the things we know, more knowledge is more power. How we use the things we know is for everyone to influence. So of course, when we design things, we have no idea what and how, usually, how they will be used. So I think the responsibility is really on everyone, and I think that somehow there should be better mechanisms to actually better communication between science and the rest of society with respect to exactly this question.
It brings up the question for we, considering your research is so specific and only a few handful of people can really understand and even imagine the implications of your work, even describing the technology to an audience in so many layman terms, we can't possibly comprehend what the technology could do in the future. And so are there no, is there nothing in place so far in an international scheme to regulate the technology? I think it's a very valid question.
I just want to make sure that one thing is understood. Even if quantum computers are built, we don't know that they are stronger than classical computers. So your question is relevant to the all of computer science, computer industry, and all applications of computers, good or bad, that you see around you. So it's possible that quantum computers will be more powerful, and then computing machinery will be more powerful, and whether it's used to create, you know, evil things or good things, that's up to the people who use it, like Dorit said, society who uses it. There is not much difference in the potential of quantum computers, as far as I can tell. Maybe other aspects of quantum information theory may find other applications. But at the end of the day, the discoveries are up to the society to use.
When I was a kid, I was a kid when the lasers were invented. And I vaguely remember that one of the proposed uses of lasers was death rays. And if lasers had been banned because of this possible use, that would have been a real catastrophe, because it turns out that lasers make really, really bad death rays and are useful for all sorts of things which are contribute to the good of society. So telling whether a technology is going to be used for good or ill at the very beginning of its birth is really, really difficult to do.
Will it be an academic responsibility, by industry?
This is a really fascinating question and important topic, probably the subject of a whole conference, let alone panel. So I think I'd like to move on to some of the other questions, but thanks very much for the very good question.
I'm just bringing a question from our online audience. Paul from all the way in New York asks, is a quantum device a tangible object or a mathematical concept? In other words, what physical equipment is actually necessary to isolate the particles involved in a computation?
It's very tangible. So there are labs in the world that they have prototypes of quantum computers, and you can go there and you can even see these atoms through a microscope, and you see how with lasers you manipulate them and how it works. It's very tangible. The only question is that we have to build them bigger, and that's something that we cannot do now, but there exist. There exist prototypes, and with these prototypes, people have factorized 15, or they have implemented some other algorithms, which at the moment they cannot compete with a classical computer, but we are able to make them bigger, then they will compete and they will beat classical computers.
So maybe it's worth adding, Paul is in New York, so can't take advantage of this, but you here in the audience can go to the tent in Waterloo Town Square and see a quantum computer in that Physics Fantastica tent. A very small one, but quantum computer nonetheless.
So next question.
Hi. I appreciate you talking about quantum physics, because basically whenever I ask a question, they all the physicists disappear, just run away. I look at computing with you, it's like with Alan Turing back in the 30s. You're just starting out and nobody believes it'll work. I don't think any one of you wants to be crucified like him, or wait 60 years for an apology from the Brits. But like, where do you think this is going? Is it going to be like dumbing it down, Star Trek with Spock's brain? Are you going to be able to have a computer that kind of has all the parts of the brain, like the six of you are, would be like parts of the brain where you can compute all these formulas at once, and exactly where is this heading?
Okay. Does anyone want to quickly answer that?
Well, so the quantum computers we're thinking of building will be a bit more like regular computers that you have on your desk or even in your BlackBerry, your smartphone, whatever. They're not really designed based on the brain. They'll solve some problems. Some problems they won't know how to solve. They won't have intuition or anything like that. They'll just be able to do what we program them to. The only difference is that they'll be able to run new kinds of programs that can only run on a quantum computer.
So, you know, from multi areas all at the same time, like basically so Andy Grove was talking.
We've run out of time, unfortunately. So won't be able to take any more questions. But so I'd like to take this chance to thank our panel for this very interesting discussion, and for the audience for their active participation. And sorry we couldn't take all the questions. So I think we're asked to exit from the on this side.